What if I asked you about that particular belief, but then I said, well, do you want to bet on it? It forces you into the world of probability and makes you realize that maybe I'm not so sure.
I'm Nick Gillespie, and today we are talking with Annie Duke. She is the Duchess of Poker. In 2004, Annie, who is now retired from professional poker, but she won a gold bracelet, World Series of Poker, and she's the author of a really great autobiography or memoir. It's called How I Raised, Folded, Bluffed, Flirted, Pursed, and Won Millions at the World Series of Poker. And today, she also has a background in cognitive science and is doing a lot of work on that and has a book that is in the works about this. We're going to be talking about poker, psychology, linguistics, prohibition, and Donald Trump, because in 2009, Annie finished second overall to Joan Rivers on Celebrity Apprentice, and so she may well have some personal insights and animus towards the next president, or possibly the last president of the United States. So, you have a connection to Pennsylvania. You did graduate work here in the psychology department or cognitive linguistics at University of Pennsylvania.
I actually have deep roots from Pennsylvania. My father grew up in West Philly, and I think he's a great example of what makes America great. Both his parents emigrated from Eastern Europe at the turn of the last century, and his father had a sixth grade education, and my father has a PhD.
But now this is, Camille Paglia said yesterday, Western civilization is declining, and your grandfather had a sixth grade education, your father is a PhD, and let's face it, you didn't finish your PhD.
I'm ABD, so I'm
you're
just,
like on the slide.
This I still have a chance, though. He did it late in life, okay. So he got his master's early, and I tied him on that. So, at any rate, but he went to West Philly High and then made his way on to eventually making his way to Harvard. So, and then so obviously those ties to Philadelphia. And then I was 5 years at the University of Pennsylvania in the psychology department doing my PhD work and almost finishing.
And it's a great story, especially given the academic job market. You left, you stopped doing work because you started playing poker professionally, right?
Basically what happened was, at the end of, my time there, I had, my job talks lined up. And I actually got ill. So I needed to take a leave of absence. So during that time, I started playing poker. And, in the first month that I played poker, I made $2,800, which I think the starting salaries of the jobs that I were looking at were right in the 23, 25 range.
Yeah.
And that, and it seemed like, wow, that was pretty good money. Aside from the fact that I actually really was completely in love with the game.
Yeah, talk about what drew you to it. And you also have a brother who is a poker player. Why, what captivated about you? And we're also, how many of you play poker or watch it on TV?
A lot of them played last night.
Yeah, we had the demonstration last night. We're in a kind of golden age of poker and recognizing poker. Maybe in the way bridge, I was talking about this with some people earlier, a couple of decades ago, bridge was seen as a fun and intense and exciting and competitive game. Poker seems to be occupying a lot of that space even more. What drew you to it, and why do you think it's, so big?
So I think that what drew me to it was the fact that it's a game and in the true sense of what a game is. So let me just explain. So chess is not actually by definition a game. And the reason that chess is not by definition a game is because, there is no hidden information. So you can see all the pieces, right? So what you can imagine with chess is assuming you had enough computing power, you could actually, calculate out what all the possible moves are. And computers have gotten pretty good at that. We have Big Blue. And that's why computers actually beat human beings now, with relative ease at a game like chess. And that game in the colloquial sense, not in the technical sense. In order for something to be technically a game, there has to be an element of hidden information. So in poker, obviously, you have hidden cards, right? So we can't see the other player's cards, which creates a really interesting decision-making problem because you're living in this world of uncertainty around what you have. So I've got to sort of figure out what cards do I think you have by watching the way that you're behaving. And then you add in this great element of luck, right? That even if I were to be able to determine exactly what you had, and I knew, for example, that I was 80% to win the hand. And so I decided to play. I would still lose 20% of the time. And we don't know which thing is going to happen on that particular iteration. I just know percentage-wise what will happen. So this creates a really interesting decision-making problem. In fact, it's so interesting that the whole field of game theory, which is an arm of economics, was based on a simplified game of poker. John von Neumann, who is the father of modern game theory, as well as the father of the modern computer, by the way. And in 1950, he was named Time Magazine's most brilliant mathematician of the time. A lot of people don't know who he is because he didn't have funny hair and an accent. Like, well, he did have an accent, but he didn't have the funny hair and the bicycle that Einstein had. But he actually was an avid poker player, loved poker. And when he was thinking about game theory, he sort of took a simplified version of poker and based it on that. So what we can imagine is if game theory, which is the study of human decision making in general, is based on poker, and you have this person who's coming from cognitive science, which is the study of human decision making, gets thrown into a poker game, think about that collision, right? So for me, that was like, oh my God, this is incredible.
And you made money.
And I made a lot. Yes, and I did well for myself, too, at the same time. That was I wouldn't have stayed if I weren't making money.
Yeah, my next question is, and you've already, I think, suggested some of them. What are the life lessons that you can sharpen by playing poker and thinking about poker and the kind of those probabilistic questions it raises, the decision making? We talked a little bit before we got up here about decision trees and kind of critical thinking skills, and talk about the work that you're doing to kind of push that along.
Sure. Well, what life lessons can poker teach us? I would say like all of them. No, but for actual, I mean, the thing is that, you know, game theory is really studying the interactions of multiple people under conditions of uncertainty over time. Doesn't that sound like what our life is? Right? So, poker can really teach us a lot about this. And one of the great things with poker is that it's a very tight and closed feedback loop. What I mean by that is that the decisions and actions are tied very, very closely in time to the outcomes, right? A hand of poker takes 2 minutes unless you have someone who's annoyingly slow with you at the table.
That would be me.
So
I've been chased off of poker tables in from Atlantic City to Las Vegas.
For being slow. There
and
you
I'm
go.
Not even allowed on the Indiana riverboats on the Ohio River. So,
and even if you have someone who's kind of slow, maybe it takes 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Right? So you're getting this feedback super, super fast. The other thing is that it's one of the few places where your competitor is sitting across from you and there's a direct exchange that happens at the end of each hand. This creates a lot of emotion around the decisions. And what basically happens is that you really can see in a very, very magnified way that our irrationalities play into our decision making. So I don't know how many of you are familiar with these books. You know, there's very popular books out there like Thinking Fast and Slow, Predictably Irrational. You know, it's all these things in behavioral economics, which is really saying we're not really rational actors. It turns out that there's we're sort of, from an evolutionary standpoint, it was rational behaviors that occurred, but not necessarily in a modern world.
But this is kind of like our brain, and it's not a computer, but it's like a computer that is soaking in an ivory liquid that is emotion.
Right. And not only that, that's so true.
And by the way, I got $5 for mentioning ivory liquid.
With Palmolive,
I think it was. Absolutely.
Right. So what I like to say is we have this humongous, you know, we have this big animal brain that's old and makes decisions about running away from lions, right? And then we have this little tiny thin layer of cortex, which was essentially invented just for us, but it's small and it has to deal with all of our deliberative decision making, right? And it's very stressed. It's got a lot to do and there's not much of it, right? So most of our decisions are happening in this other part of our brain. So when you play poker, you can really see these kinds of irrational decisions coming to the fore. And then what's really wonderful about it is you can say, what have the top slice of poker players done? Because there's only a little top thin slice of them who are really persisting and doing well in the game. What are they doing that's building walls around those kinds of behaviors so that other people aren't necessarily implementing? And then you can just take that out into, well, since we know that this is really decision-making distilled, in like a petri dish, we can now take that out into the world and take those lessons with us.
Can you give a concrete example, say in a poker situation, where I guess the question is not to bleach out emotion, but to control it or make sure it's not controlling you. But from a poker game to a real life situation, like how?
Sure. That's a great question. And if I couldn't answer that, it would be really bad, right?
So
I have to think about all the examples. Yes. So I'll give you a really easy one that you'll all understand. And you'll see very quickly how it plays out in pretty much everything. So one of the puzzles for me when I started playing poker was that when I was in graduate school, I learned that learning occurs under conditions where there's lots and lots of decisions and actions tied closely in time to feedback. It's a very simple, it's kind of what Pavlov taught us, right, with his dogs and the bells and the salivating. Okay, so I understood that. So now I go and I sit down and I play poker and I say, hold on a second. There's lots and lots of decisions and actions tied very closely in time to feedback, and yet I can win at the game, right? And I'm watching people make the same mistakes over and over again for like 20 years. So that was very puzzling to me because of my academic background, right? I was confused by that. So one of the first things I noticed that really explained that for me was I said, well, what are people doing with the feedback they're getting? Because that's really where they're going to learn from, right? So what happens when they get a bad outcome? They say, ah, I got so unlucky. Because remember, this is an ambiguous world that we're making decisions in, right? It's not chess, where I can say I moved my knight into the wrong place with surety, right? I can say, oh, I just got unlucky. I was actually supposed to win, but the math was against me, right? Mm-hmm. So I can say that. I can say I got unlucky. What happens when they win? I'm so smart and the most brilliant player that ever lived. So what's happening? They're socializing their bad outcome and they're privatizing their good outcomes. Now, this should be pretty familiar to everybody, right? Like I have a son who's just finishing high school and my gosh, he has never come home with a bad grade on a test where it wasn't because the teacher's really hard and the test was really hard and he put things on the test that weren't actually taught in class. And also the teacher really doesn't like him. And if I have any questions about that, I should just go ask everyone in his class and they will confirm that. But when he gets a good grade, it's like, Mom, I got a 95. I worked so hard. Can we go out to dinner? So, and we can see this in the election cycle, right? It's like, why am I doing poorly? It's their fault. And we can pick, right? We can look at the sort of spectrum. And there's people on one side of the aisle saying it's their fault looking down from them. And there's other people saying it's their fault looking up, right? But it's not your fault, right? Right. So this is very, very, very common. Actually, in one of the debates, there was something very funny. Chris Christie said about Hillary Clinton and Benghazi, don't you worry. You know, she's just saying that's not her fault. But if it had worked out, she'd be the first one to take credit for it, right? About 5 minutes later, he was asked about Bridgegate, to which he said, oh, I didn't know anything about that. That wasn't my fault. So you can see this. This is really everywhere out there in the world, and it's a really big problem.
Talk a bit about how you've said that you've learned from watching other players succeed and fail, and that there's, you know, learning how to become multi-perspectival, I guess, for a $5 word for just saying, like, actually recognizing you have limits to knowledge and that you can gain from understanding how other people.
That's great. So that's actually part of the way that you solve for the problem that I just talked about. So one of the things we want to do is be really good disconnectors of outcome and decision, right? So we can do that through good culture, right? So I had a wonderful group of players around me who, if I came and just said, oh, I just got unlucky, I would be challenged on that fact by them, right? And they would say, I'm not interested in that. If you just got unlucky, there's no learning to be had from it. What could you learn from the hand? So I had people helping me because one of the things you learn is these things are so deep within us. We need good culture and good social structure around us to challenge us. So I was taught, if I have nothing to say about the hand besides I got unlucky or I'm so great, that I actually got very bad social negative feedback from discussing those kinds of hands with the people around me. I actually had to find learning experiences. So as I was doing that and I was kind of learning from these great players, including my brother, Howard Lederer, who's amazing, I found myself thinking, oh, okay, well, so now I kind of have this idea of how you're supposed to play. And I sat down at tables and people were not playing according to what I had been told, right? So my first instinct was to just assume they were bad, right? Just to say, oh, they're bad because they're doing something different than me. They clearly have no idea what they're doing. Well, taking the lessons of what my culture was teaching me about trying to get more deeply into that and not sort of going with what your first instinct is, I set a rule for myself. Well, okay, this seems like this is sort of in that category, so I'm going to set a rule. My job, if I see anybody at the table, is to find the one thing that they do better than I do. Because even if they're overall a losing player, even if most of the things that they do are actually not the like what the optimal strategy is, there's probably something they're doing that's better than me, and I've got to figure out what that is.
Talk about that in the context of discussing this just a couple minutes ago, but about a kind of political information or political frameworks. As you were saying, you know, what does a Fox News watcher gain right. from looking at MSNBC? How does that factor into this idea of trying to get outside of our immediate emotional response?
So
what we know is true.
So what happens is that what I was falling prey to is really something called confirmation bias. So I had an idea of how you were supposed to play, and if someone was falling out of that, I just assumed they were bad because that confirmed my belief that I knew what I was doing, right? It made me feel good about myself. So if you think about this, this is the actions that we get all over the map, and you particularly see it with politics. And you particularly see it right now because obviously emotions are running very high, and whenever emotions run high, these things kind of explode, right? So if I am a Fox News watcher, I have certain beliefs about politics, right? Do I want someone to tell me my beliefs are wrong? No, because that makes me feel bad. So what do I naturally do? I walk into an echo chamber and I go and watch Fox News and they tell me all the things that I already believe and I feel really good about myself, right? Just like poker players, the majority of poker players didn't have the luck of being forced into a good culture like I was by my brother. And this is what they do. Oh, can you believe how bad that guy played? Yeah, he's horrible. Right. And that's literally what the conversation is like as you're walking down the halls. Right. So, I recommend to people that they do what I did at the poker table. Right. Which I was lucky enough to do at the poker. If you are a Fox News watcher, go watch the Rachel Maddow show and don't watch it to yell at the TV and scream about how wrong she is. Go watch it with a group of your Fox News friends and come back and reconvene after having watched Rachel Maddow. And each of you has to say the one thing that she said that you agree with, the one thing that made you maybe rethink something. Vice versa, if you watch MSNBC, go watch Bill O'Reilly and figure out the thing it is that he's saying that seems to make some sense. My particular news source, a lot of my news source is actually Real Clear Politics. Why? Because if I read every single article on there, I get far right, far left, libertarian, everything, because they're just aggregating, right, across the political spectrum. And I think that that makes us all better thinkers because it forces us to put ourselves in another view. It forces us to realize that the world isn't black and white. It's not, we're never 100% correct or 0% correct. It's always somewhere
you
between.
You obviously haven't heard what my staff says about me in editorial meeting. But,
yeah, but that you're 100% correct or zero. Which one?
Zero. It's always zero. And I was going to say, after you instructed us to watch Rachel Maddow and Bill O'Reilly, for the first time in my life public, I will say, just turn off the TV. Okay? Go. Don't even read a book. Just take a nap or something. let me try and put something of a libertarian spin on what you're talking about. A lot of libertarian thought, and I don't want to force a label on you, but if you want to talk about, your personal ideology, a lot of libertarian thought, and certainly coming out of people like Friedrich von Hayek, it stresses the limits of knowledge, that knowledge is real and it's cumulative, and we can learn more about the world and we can learn more about probabilities, but ultimately we know less at any given point, and I think this goes to some of what John and Adrian were talking about in the previous session. We know less than we think, and we gain from having overlapping frameworks by which to understand the world or to challenge our belief system. So we understand we're in a system and we're swimming in water that maybe is not the limit of the world. So you do a lot of work on critical thinking. This is your big push. You want to increase critical thinking, whether it's in the C-suite or whether it's for lower income children who might not be exposed to this type of stuff. Talk about, is there a libertarian edge to what you're talking about here? And then particularly of getting younger people to think critically with kind of multiple frameworks or in a pluralistic way, that there is not one final answer, only one way of looking at the world. How is that going?
So I co-founded a nonprofit called How I Decide. And basically the work, so I do keynoting and corporate retreats and consulting on decision-making, critical thinking skills with executives. And I then take that into, through How I Decide, creating innovation, both high touch and high scale, products and interventions to teach critical thinking and decision skills with a focus on underserved youth, particularly middle schoolers, although we serve some other people. So I think that the thing that you said in there that's the most important is this idea of probabilistic thinking, right? That things aren't 100% true or 0% true. And that if we understand that, that we're sort of swimming in the waters of uncertainty, I think that we all become better belief updaters. And I think that that's really where the core of the problem is that we aren't good belief updaters. And the reason is that we've got this process in place. We think that the way that our beliefs are formed are that we hear something or read something about something. We then ponder it and think about it and vet the information, and then we form a belief. Wrong order, exactly. So the way it actually works is we hear something, we believe it, and this has been shown in several studies. If anybody, Dan Gilbert is the place that you would go look to find that. He wrote a book called Stumbling on Happiness later, but his original work was on this. We hear something, we believe it, and then if we have the time or inclination, we go and check it out later on, which mostly actually doesn't happen. The reason for that is very simple. Evolution likes to work with structures that already exist because we can't take our brains out of our head and install a new iOS. It doesn't work that way. So how did we mostly form beliefs? Well, with our eyes, right? Seeing is believing. I see a tree. The tree exists. Is there a reason for the middle step of, well, let me vet whether this tree exists? Not really, because I already saw it. So that's how our abstract belief formation system works. Now, what the problem is that once we form a belief, which we haven't vetted really well, we notice information that reinforces the beliefs. We don't tend to notice information that discounts it. And in fact, if we are actually presented with information that does discount it, we will do all sorts of mental gymnastics to try to discredit this. You see this if you watch the Eagles and the Cowboys play a game and both fans come away and the refs have cheated them, which obviously is impossible. But that's what you do. You're noticing all the calls that go only against your team and you're discounting everything else that happens. And because you have a belief that this is why you lost and the refs are cheating you, right? So what would happen instead if we have a belief, if we were forced to think about it as if it were a bet, which forced us into thinking about probability, right? So, as an example, I like to talk about the fact, normally I would have people raise their hands, but we don't have time for that here, but
there's a lot of amputees in the audience. Yeah. So that, thank you for being thoughtful.
So, people in general have a belief about how you could predict if a man will go bald. And I'm sure that all of you know this. You look at the mother's father, the paternal grandfather, right? And this is a very commonly held belief. You probably know that, right? So it turns out that that's not actually true.
You know, just cut it with the ad hominems.
But yeah. So it turns out that that's not true, actually, that it's actually many, many genes that are involved in figuring out if a man's going to go bald. And in fact, many of them from the paternal side.
I thought we were going to talk about Trump at the end. But
right, now we're getting there already. Another really commonly held belief is that if you want to figure out what your dog's age is in human years, you would multiply each year that your dog has lived by 7. That's also not true because it's not linear. But these are beliefs that are very commonly held that we don't really question, and we walk around and declare them to be true. And every time we see a paternal grandfather who's bald, you say, aha, right? And if they're not bald, you just ignore it. But what if I asked you about that particular belief, but then I said, well, do you want to bet on it? All of a sudden, you start saying, well, now let me think about this for a second. Where did I hear that? What have I done? Have I actually looked at the evidence? Because you got to put some money on it now, right? It forces you into the world of probability and makes you realize that maybe I'm not so sure. And it's a simple thing for a poker player to think about, because this is all I do. I'm betting on my confidence level about what your hand is, right? So I walk around in the world and I say, well, I think that such and such is going to happen, but I'm like 73%. And that's sort of the normal way that I talk. What if you incorporated that into the normal way that you talk? How wonderful that would be. Now, if you hear new information that contradicts it can't even contradict your belief. It just allows you to update your percentage, right? So if I say, oh, you know, I read this really interesting article about what would happen if the minimum wage were raised, but I'm not an economist. So my faith in that, given the source, is like, you know, I'm like 78% that a lot of what was said in there was true. Now, if I read something else, I can just update that, right? I can say, well, now I'm 71% or now I'm 85%. You're not living in wrong or right anymore, which is really beautiful. But the other thing is, I serve you well when I say I'm 80%, because now you understand, well, this is sort of where I'm sitting and maybe we can explore this together. I invite you into a social exploration of the belief. And we'd all be so much better off if we thought about things that way.
Could you comment briefly, and I know you're no longer kind of working the, you lobbied to make online gambling or online poker playing.
I did
playing
at one legal. Point, yeah.
But why is card playing, and particularly things like poker, why, you know, and given the way that you just, I think, had a great, you know, way to take its lessons to every aspect of our lives, why is it considered a vice?
Because gambling is considered a vice in some religious system. So I think that... But I think it's a little more complicated than
and
that.
And is it because it was perceived as luck or because it's rigged? Or, I mean, I guess it's a combination, or it's just somehow contravening a higher power.
So it's not actually prohibited in the Bible. Let me just say that. There isn't a prohibition against gambling in the Bible, but...
As the religious people remember, didn't they gamble for Jesus's clothes?
Yeah, I think right? they did, yeah.
But it was crap, right?
Right. They played a lot of
craps,
like, dice
which has
games.
Like the best odds in the house. So, you know, they knew what they were
Well,
doing.
If you play it correctly, it can have the worst odds in the house. You actually have to play a good strategy, and you're still losing, by the way. Let me just say that.
I've known that my whole life.
I can get you to where you're losing less than 1%, but that's the best I can do for you. So I think this speaks to the problem of, I think people are very uncomfortable with uncertainty and uncomfortable with kind of thinking probabilistically. It's why How I Decide wants to really get people to, kids, to be better decision makers. So they grow up into people who are okay with uncertainty, because what happens is that you've got this stuff happening and people don't really understand why it's happening and it feels like luck, right? And somehow that doesn't feel good to them. What I do in poker isn't luck. In the long run, I'm just grinding out an edge like anybody is. If you open a business, like I assume you're trying to grind out a positive expectancy, I hope. Some people think they have that, but they don't, but whatever. So I think that then got into this world of like, we want to protect people from themselves because they're going to get involved in this thing that's just luck. You know, meanwhile, lotteries seem to be totally exempted from this whole idea that's immoral, which I don't even want to. But, and I think that it's that there's this weird, it's like uncertain and we don't know. And that feels bad. And it feels like it's all just fate and people are going to get attracted to that. And so we have to protect them from that decision, when actually that would be a really good life lesson for people. It's actually quite the opposite, aside from the fact that particularly poker in particular. And I think whether you have an edge or not, you should have the right to engage in it regardless. But poker in particular is very odd because it's something where you can actually, there's a huge skill element.
Do you think, you mentioned that you have a son, a lot of us have children, you know, kids, boys and girls are gaming more and more. And a lot of these games are actually, you know, they're percentage games. Is that helping create, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, people were complaining about gaming as a, you know, as a horrific impact on kids' influence. Do you think it's helping to teach some of these lessons? Because they're very complicated.
Yeah, so I'll tell you how much I think that might be true. Part of what we've done at How I Decide is we funded a guy named Adam Gazzoli, who is a neuroscientist at UCSF, at University of California, San Francisco. And what he does is create video games in order to solve neurological issues, where what he says is that small molecules, medicines, are very blunt instruments, right? They kind of work across the brain. He's not saying eliminate those, but he's saying maybe you can get in there with a more precision instrument and actually work on the circuitry that's actually being affected in whatever the cognitive deficit might be. His original work was on something called NeuroRacer. I highly recommend you look at it. He made the cover of Nature, looking at 70-year-olds and getting them to perform in certain areas of cognitive decline as if they were now 25-year-olds. Wow. Through the use of a video game, he's got that now with the FDA, trying to get FDA approval for the first time for a video game. I think it's incredibly innovative. So what we're doing at How I Decide is thinking about something called delay of gratification, which has to do with temporal discounting, which is how good are you at balancing out your future utility with your present. So if I offer you $100 a day or $130 in a year, which one are you taking? Right. And I can sort of figure out how much you value the future over the present. Now, it turns out that this is very predictive of success for kids. If I take 4-year-olds and I say, do you want a marshmallow now? Or you can sit with that marshmallow for 15 minutes. And if you don't eat it, you'll get a second marshmallow. About 15% of 4-year-olds are able to resist eating the marshmallow. And it's very predictive of all sorts of things, like how you do in your job or your marriage or whatever. So we know that if we can train up this delay of gratification, that it can have all sorts of good results. You can imagine it would make you a better studier and maybe Snapchatting less, right? So that would be good. So we're working with him to create a video game for 12 to 16-year-olds that would actually specifically promote this issue of delay of gratification. We're about to go into piloting. We're about 9 months into the project, 6 months of piloting and then 6 months of testing, including EEG and fMRI data to go along with it. So you can see what's happening in the brain and then validated batteries to see what's happening in behavior. And we're crossing our fingers for great results. So we love video games as tools to teach decision making.
You know, yesterday when Camille Polly was talking, I asked her to make a case for the humanities to people who might be more interested in science. You have a science background, but you also majored as an undergrad in English.
I did.
Talk a little bit about how, facility with language, reading literature, and learning to write actually helped you get to where you are.
I think having knowledge is great, but if you can't communicate it, then the knowledge is sitting in your head and people don't really understand you. So what I found was that, so my dad was an English teacher. So I kind of had that kind of growing up and wanting to follow in his footsteps a little bit. One of my two majors at Columbia was English Lit. I did science as my second one. When I got to graduate school, I got funneled in with nobody who had ever been in an English class, except for it happened to maybe have been a requirement to get your degree, right? So these weren't people who were sitting in the humanities. And I had been straddling the two worlds. Now, in graduate school, everything is done by Blue Book essay. And lo and behold, I sort of got like that extra half grade, not because my knowledge was better than theirs, not because I was more intelligent than they were, but because I could construct and express an argument in a way that they just simply hadn't been trained to do. So the stuff that I said sounded better, right? And I found that I've really carried that through my life. I taught poker seminars for many years. And what I discovered was that if I conceptually thought something was true, I better be able to explain it really well and construct a coherent argument. And if I couldn't do that, I would actually go back and rethink the concept that I thought was true, because being able to translate that is so important. What I do when I get up and talk about behavioral economics to executives, I've got to do the same thing. I've got to be able to construct that argument from start to finish to get it to be understandable to them so that they can actually learn the lessons of what I'm trying to teach. And I think that that was so incredibly important, is that I think about argumentation in a way of, you know, thesis sentence. Mm-hmm. What pieces of evidence am I going to drop in? Like, what are going to be my secondary theses? You know, and I've got to be able to support those, because I did that for 4 years. And I think that that was actually incredibly valuable in both my communication skills, but also in my critical thinking skills for myself, because it caused me to change the way that I think about a lot of things when I recognized that I couldn't construct one of those arguments. It makes you challenge yourself.
Do you have a favorite book, movie, or poem about gambling or about poker?
No.
Okay.
Not really. Although... I mean, I like the Cincinnati Kid, but I think that's because I like Steve McQueen more than...
Yeah, okay, that's...
Because the poker in that's really dumb.
Yeah, that's the emotional...
I also like Edward G. Robinson, by the way. I mean, I just like the cast of that. There were some great...
I think with Steve McQueen, it's the emotion overwhelming the frontal cortex, right?
Especially right, exactly.
At that time in his life.
Right, exactly.
So, well, we're going to talk about Trump briefly, and then let's open it up. So you were on The Celebrity Apprentice. Many of us have heard of Donald Trump. What was it like? And I know in past interviews you've said, it's not like you got to know him in any kind of deep way, but that what you see is what you get. What kind of character, what kind of character is it?
Well, I mean, I would say what I said in the past interviews is, I was asked, are you surprised by what you've seen during the election, having spent some significant amount of time with him? And my answer is no. I'm not surprised by it. What you saw when I was on The Apprentice is very much in line with what I've seen during the campaign. And I think that one of the things that Trump really got is how to create great reality TV. I mean, the fact is, I wasn't an Apprentice watcher before I went on it, and I wasn't an Apprentice watcher after I got off the show. It's not, it's just not kind of my deal. But I mean, obviously, it was a really well-watched show. Yeah. So he was doing something to get eyeballs on
him. What is it? Is it that, is it his projection of confidence, even though he might change what he says he deeply believes in from moment to moment, but at every time he says it with absolute conviction and authority? And then occasionally he'll be like, I don't know. You know, because when, I mean, it was an interesting moment a couple weeks ago when he was talking with Chris Matthews on Hardball. And Chris Matthews was trying to get him to talk about abortion. And he's like, it's got to be illegal. And then Chris Matthews says, well, if it's illegal, should there be punishment for the woman? And he said, yeah, there has to be, because if it's illegal, then there has to be punishment. And Matthews said, what punishment? And he's like, I don't know, but there has to be something. So, I mean, he's, it's a weird, I mean, he is both over, he seems overconfident, bullying, but then also strangely humble sometimes when he doesn't know. I mean, what, you know, what is it about him that you think is capturing, you know, quite possibly the Republican domination?
Well, so first of all, I'd like to say that despite you having said that you'd shut the TV off, I just found out you do sometimes watch MSNBC.
Oh, yeah. No, trust me, I watch it all. I'm DVRing this whole weekend so I can catch up. Yeah.
So I think actually what you're touching on is kind of interesting. So let's just assume for the sake of argument that you have a person where the truth is not important, right? I'm not speaking directly to that. I'm just saying, just hypothetically, you have someone like that who is willing to make statements with great confidence, okay? I just told you how beliefs are formed, right? People hear them, they believe them. And then basically, once that belief is formed, they're looking for confirming evidence, and they're kind of not noticing things that don't confirm it. So think about actually how, in a way, brilliant it is to state opposing sides of an argument at different times with great confidence. It's literally something for everybody. And now if you sort of have a tendency to believe one thing, you go, haha, see, that's believed. And you're not kind of noticing the other stuff. Or remember, I said people will do big mental gymnastics to actually discredit disconfirming evidence. So it's, well, I don't think that, that would actually get implemented, or I don't think that's actually his true belief. This other thing is the true belief. So in a weird way, Trump is actually an amazing behavioral scientist, right? Like, he understands intuitively, I think, something very deep about the way we form beliefs and then what we want to kind of hear back as regards to our beliefs. So it's confusing to people, I think, who are analysts and pundits and trying to get deep down into, well, what's the reality, right? It's confusing because you can see so easily, well, there's some contradictions there. But to the listeners, to the average person who's listening, that's actually quite brilliant, right? I heard that, you know, he's for intervention. He's going to blow up, you know, all of Syria. And they're like, yes, I really like that. Or, oh, he says he's going to be an isolationist, right, and he's not going to get involved. Oh, yes, I really like that. And I think he's just saying the other stuff so that people who like that will vote for him. I don't really believe that. And that's kind of what you have across the board. And it's not like, this isn't necessarily unique to Trump. You've seen some pivots, right? So Cruz, for example, a strict constitutionalist, but also maybe okay with Supreme Court justices being voted out, just as an example of something, you know, you've seen some from Sanders.
Or people will say about Cruz, well, he doesn't really mean it when he's talking about immigration, or that's not his real belief.
That's not his real belief, right? So people say that as well. You know, on the Sanders side, you hear this again, very similar to Trump, repeating of the same themes over and over again with great conviction, right? Where, he's really implanting that belief in people, right? I mean, saying just those things repeatedly, again, with great force and great conviction, implants those beliefs. And now people are hearing that back in a way that feels very good to them, right? I mean, Clinton obviously has shifted quite a few to give something for everyone, right?
So would you say she, in a way, I mean, certainly Trump and Sanders have this insurgency going, and it's fascinating that they're actually independents who have done really well in party primaries, the parties they don't even belong to in any real way. Cruz also, you know, has some energy. Hillary is the presumptive, you know, in most polls she would win. She's going to be the Democratic nominee. Does she have, and yet she seems to be grating on even her biggest fans. Is she doing something wrong, or is she actually doing something right in kind of that bonding moment with the way she's projecting herself?
It's hard to say. I mean, I feel a little bit like, I don't know. I think that I'm very biased because I'm a woman. And so I think I'm biased towards saying that, like, when someone's saying that her decibel level is loud mm-hmm. in a negative way, that, well, Sanders' decibel level is quite loud as well, right? So people aren't commenting on that. So I don't know if that's what you're, you know, so I think that I wonder if there's a little bit of a different standard there. I think part of the problem with Clinton is that she's Clinton, so she's been around for a really long time. And I think that there's a very vocal part of the electorate that clearly is saying that they don't want people who are entrenched and have been around for a long time.
So the enthusiasm gap is similar to Jeb Bush. It's like,
we know your name. Yeah. And obviously there's a balance of experience versus what's considered sort of entrenchment and part of the mm-hmm. establishment machine and sort of what people feel like have been hurting them. And I think that that's what you're finding. I think, though, that what you'll find is that in general, I think that I'm guessing that the anger toward the establishment in the country in general is actually less than we think it is. And I'm not saying that in some ways it's more than we think it is, in the sense that obviously we have these insurgent candidates, but they're also the loudest voices. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the voting in the Democratic Party, despite the fact, obviously, that you're getting this huge number of votes coming for Sanders, in the end, Clinton's winning by like 3 million votes of people who are bothering to get out to the primaries, who tend to be the more motivated. So the evidence kind of suggests that, yes, that's true, and there's definitely a voice for it, but maybe it's not as huge as you think. And certainly I think that's true on the Republican side. I mean, there's still a large majority of Republicans who say we don't really want that insurgency, right? But there's something called availability bias, which is when you hear something and it's very loud and very frequent, very loud and sort of covered on TV a lot, we judge the frequency to be much higher than it actually is. So I would be interested to see, like, if you actually could do a real poll, you know, what those numbers actually look like.